great. Well, a certain sumptuousness of a very different nature, and maybe slickness, but of a very different proportion in the very ambitious, physically and intellectually, installation of T.J. Wilcox at the Whitney Museum of American Art. Stephen.
Loved it.
Yeah.
You were going to ask. You know, my heart sank. I looked up, I saw the 10 projectors. I thought, this is going to go on forever. I haven't eaten lunch yet. What am I doing? But I was completely drawn in. Mm-hmm. About halfway through the first small short film, which in my case was the Empire State Building film. Quickly, for those who haven't seen it, there's a series of six. You have that view of Manhattan in the round from the artist's studio, says on the wall, and that's interspersed with six short films. Most of them taken mostly from found films. So there's a piece on the Empire State Building, and the Zeppelin mooring, which turns into a sort of a meditation on the Hindenburg and the end of Zeppelin air travel. A short piece on Gloria Vanderbilt, one on Antonio Lopez, the fashion illustrator. This is going around the room, and each film is aligned with the view from the corresponding view from this rooftop.
And we, the audience, can be either side of the donut, so to speak. We can.
Yeah,
we
the
can
pictures
be
were
in
just
it.
From the outside.
That's yeah. right. Yes. Yeah. I take it that the ideal viewing spot is in the middle of the donut.
It is. Yeah.
You see the film from either side, also a film, an interview with a fellow named John, who evidently is the building supervisor, who was talking about his experience at 9/11, and observing the horrific events of 9/11 through binoculars. So all the films become, in a way, about perception and about optics, in a way, about the camera, or about a sort of mediated image, it's a connect the dots kind of exercise, but I thought it was really beautifully pulled off. And if anything, I was ready for more of those little movies.
And there was more to be had, Faye, in the yes, side screenings. There's a whole program. It's the artist as curator, as instigator. It's a Gesamtkunstwerk, a sort of total work of art, that the segments sort of adding up to something bigger than itself. But then, in addition, there's the side room with the curated works drawn from the Whitney's collection, like the Florian Stettheimer, the Cornell, the Ouija that we showed. But then this, you could sit there all day and for a day and watch quite a rich program, sort of decade by decade, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I can't say enough good things about this show. And now that I'm teaching regularly, I feel that this show is sort of the best of what contemporary art can offer, in the sense that, okay, here's this guy, he's got the 360-degree view of Manhattan from his apartment, so that is what he's seeing. But I feel like the way he stretches out in this to encompass not only the view, but also time, history, other artists, I feel like in particular the thing that you're talking about, the curated section of films, where he selected a film from each decade to show, and they are marvelous films. There's the Helen Levitt, that famous film of the little children in East Harlem on Halloween. There's the an incredible Jack Smith film. There's a way that he just extends the discourse so generously in time and space that it's not just a question of seeing all of New York, but kind of reaching to the whole art world. And it gives you such a good feeling about what that art world can be, the kinds of connections that can be made, the kind of honoring he does of not only his predecessors, but his contemporaries, to me is kind of what art should be about. And not just about necessarily And it's historical as well. So to my mind, it reaches both across. It's optically obviously quite ambitious, but also just time, space, and a social, a kind of a sense of a kind of social commitment to other artists and art making. To me, it just there's just no end of good to say about it. And yes, you could spend an entire day there and not tire of it.
Yeah, the historical layering that Faye refers to, Joan, it often touches on an elegiac aspect. I mean, it's certainly by ending with 9/11 and with the,
yes,
the very extended
that Orsler.
There's the Orsler film in the side room, and within the donut, as Stephen has described, has mentioned, there's John the super witnessing 9/11. But then, as we go back over the back into the time, when we look at Antonio, we're looking at an AIDS victim, a marginalized illustrator, but I mean, highly successful and popular illustrator. But it's the sense of a sense of loss, and with the Zeppelin, the sense of loss, and with the Vanderbilt story, the sense of the mother losing the daughter. Joan, is the overwhelming feeling a melancholy one?
I didn't get that. No, I found. Sitting there, usually I can get really impatient with stuff like that, and I found I really was able to sit there just because of the way the whole experience was structured. And I started to think about how artists often try to create something that, in its form, it mirrors the way that we perceive and remember and experience the world around us. And I think by sitting inside of that donut and watching these clips, you get a beautiful sense of that. It's like you have these little, I remembered stories. I never knew Antonio Lopez, but I certainly heard plenty of stories about him when I first came to New York, and all of these other little vignettes that have been described, they came off to me like little pockets of your own memory and of like the collective memory of New Yorkers. And so it did feel, in a sense, like a kind of love letter to New Yorkers, but it was so beautifully done and so poetically edited that I was totally captivated. And I found there was a kind of generosity in his work where you could sit there and look at these things, and there was time to take in everything he was trying to give you, but there was also time to take in your own response to what was being shown. And that seemed like a very rare kind of experience these days, where we're often just, the onslaught of information and images wipes out our own response to things while we're seeing them.
Yes, that's incredibly beautifully put, Joan. Thanks for that. And it's a tribute to him that he pulls it out. Now, I think there's a consensus here about the generosity and the richness of the show. But Stephen, I feel that his work is a curatorial work. A Floor of the Whitney has become sort of what the Queen's Museum sometimes feels like in a way, but done with incredibly more taste because it's been done by an artist. But it's this historical layering, this time to examine vignettes, different aspects. It really does feel like it's adding up to something, but it seems that he's a very strange mix of being the sort of artistic or curatorial dictator who can bring all of these forces to play, and an incredible modesty that we don't walk out with it with a Wilcox view of the universe. We're just left to put the pieces together and, in a way, have learned something about New York and have our own new
our
feelings.
Own view of the universe.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's.
But
I think
that's
it's,
that yeah. We don't really expect that from artists, do we? We expect, we hope we get that from a good curator, but we usually want a little bit of overwhelming egotism from an artist, don't we?
I don't know how to answer that, so I'm going to say something else.
Okay.
I'll just say no, no, no.
Along the lines of the modesty.
Yes.
Of Wilcox. Wilcox's modesty, and I like the idea of the plugging into a collective memory of of the art world, but I think specifically New York. I think Joan is right. It seems like it's a very New York-centric piece. In the Antonio Lopez piece, I think where the Wilcox piece crystallized for me is at the end of that Antonio Lopez vignette. There's a he notices Wilcox is recounting his experience of looking at some photographs of from Lopez's studio, and he notices that in the background of one of these candid shots mm-hmm. of one of the models is the same or very nearly view of Union Square, of a building off Union Square, and he realizes that his studio, Antonio's studio, was in the next building. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's where the whole piece kind of clicked mm-hmm. into focus. Yeah. Yeah. And I thought, well, this is really about finding one's way as an artist, finding one's way into the art world, finding one's way in the world. So that's kind of what I'm coming away from it with. I don't know how to answer your question about the egotism of the artist. But I've heard about that stuff.
Can I speak to something?
Yeah.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, Stephen, because I'm with you on that. That's where that whole piece comes together, is at the
that
end of that Antonio
the, yeah.
at that end think? Of that Antonio video.
Yes.
But can we just backtrack a little bit mm-hmm. from that, which is that earlier in the video, he talks about how he, and by the way, the whole thing, well, you know this, but the whole thing is silent, and it's just captions, right. Which I also found the sheer quietness of that piece to be just mm. so elegant and beautiful. But if you backtrack a little in that little film, he says when he came to New York in the 80s, he had an idea of what New York was going to be. And he arrived in New York in the 80s, and all of a sudden he found that everybody that he ever expected to be his mentor, the people that he admired, were dying of AIDS. Mm-hmm. And Antonio, of course, was also fell prey to the disease, and he died as well. And that sense, what he's saying at the end is that he lost so much. He came to a city that was absolutely devastated, and that he then, when he found that view, it kind of reminded him that there was still, he was connected in this way. He was connected to Antonio, and he was, and that the art world really was still there, the world of New York, the creative world of New York. And that's just what I want to say, is that his view is so, he makes it so personal at the same time as he's plugging into these very major issues, historical issues or whatever. I think it's that you were talking about the sort of political, how could Wenge-Chimu to open up a little, you know, and I feel like the way Wilcox does it is that he makes it all so incredibly intimate and personal and tells you this very personal story, and then suddenly you are opened into this giant view of what art can be and what our lives can be today, our creative lives can be.
Mm. Right. Yeah. Well, I'm still not getting the issue, though, of... Well, no, I think
I am. Is that ego?
Ego.
I don't think ego matters, really,
no.
in this instance, other than to say, yeah, he sets up for us. He lays out, in a rather subtle way, the ingredients for us to make our own meal, but there is the hint of what the meal should taste like from the ingredients that he's gathered. Is that the way it is?
I would never put it that way, but
I mean,
but if you will.
But what you started to say, Faye, about the, and Stephen, you launched us into this, which I think is really the important point about the piece, is that when he discovers that connection to where Antonio's studio is, you feel connected. You feel connected into the whole network that he sets up.
And into his view.
And he gives you that experience of being connected. And that's like a gift. And that, I think artists, in order to be able to do that, they have to like put their ego on the back burner, because in the end, it's something else that's going on. And it was a beautiful thing.
And there's a strong sense that Union Square is a place of labor, and that that he's laboring in his studio. This is the view of the whole city, and then we're taken to these moments, the sense of the Empire State Building serving as a Zeppelin port, or the sense of Even the, maybe the Vanderbilts was a little bit of a slightly sort of camp detour in a way, but most of the stories, and especially Antonio, really was a sense of working people, artists as workers rather than artists as special or privileged people.
But before you diss the campiness of the Gloria Vanderbilt piece, I think also that his work, all of his work, is very much about this kind of sentimental, overly sentimental, somewhat melodramatic, sometimes operatic, very gay sensibility, honestly. And I feel like that is also a way that our emotions get played on in that. And so we are not left with some kind of an arid discourse about this sort of thing. But in fact, we're played on emotionally. Mm-hmm. And what you were saying, Joan, it's like, it's true. And then suddenly the view that you're sitting in the middle of is your view. You know, it's no longer his view. It's ours too. We've been touched emotionally by this.
I think that's masterful.
It is. It's amazing. Mm.
Yes. But it's in a way sort of presenting a secret history of the city. It's almost something. The surrealists had this notion that there's some secret passage you could go through, any number of doors and within apartments and shops and buildings without ever having to go in the street. You could cross the whole of Paris by just finding this mysterious trail. And in a way, I felt like that was going on with this piece, that you have this in the round 360 degrees of panorama, but when you've got these displays coming up one by one with these stories and in different periods, that somehow you could pass ghosts on the way around the city.
Well, I'm trying to work out how the vision thing works into this. Do we have a little bit more time for the
show? Yeah, we
vision,
do.
Vision, because it's, as Faye points out, they are silent. This isn't a multimedia presentation. The films are silent, so we're reading the caption, we're not hearing it. John, the super, discusses, he wishes he never got those binoculars. Remember the horrible story?
Yeah, he sees the bodies falling from there.
With Lopez, it's the view out the window. With Gloria Vanderbilt, he makes a point that she was, epically photographed, by everyone throughout her life. So the camera plays in there. Even the Warhol story about launching the silver balloons from the roof of the factory, as Pope Paul VI drove by.
The phallic balloons.
Okay. At the moment that I think it was Billy Name took the photograph, there's something, and I haven't figured this out by any means, but there's something buried in there about photography in particular, but visuality in general. And it's, you know, we're all connected, and it's a collective memory. But I think that something about that a collective memory rests on optics or photography. Because it seems like a very strong connective tissue, connective strand that runs through everything.
He did talk about that. You know, I interviewed him for Peace and Art in America. We have this feature called Muse, where the artist talks about what's inspired them, and he talked about actually how that really is very important to him in this piece. The idea of what do you see? That's what he said. He said this is the most important thing, and that's why. In the back, you have the Felix Gonzalez Torres, the sand. Mm-hmm. Do we know that that's New York? I don't know. But the point being that he said, you look down and you see the traces of the person in the sand. What do you see from wherever you are? Mm-hmm. That is extremely important to him. He didn't speak about photography, but he did speak about that.
I think it's enough if there's this sort of violin that runs through the whole symphony, you know, that sort of ties things together a little bit. I don't know that it's necessary to nail it down maybe any more than we have.
Some instruments can provide texture rather than melody. Correct. Well, audience, let's deal with the shows in reverse order as we discuss them, because the Wilcox is most vivid in our memory now. So let's deal first with T.J. Wilcox at the Whitney. Any observations, comments, queries about? Yes.
I just happened to just happened to see it today, incidentally, and was really annoyed by Madonna yelling at me all the time, so I left.
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing you.
Yeah.
Can you?
Sorry, is that better? Okay.
Yes.
I was really annoyed by Madonna yelling at me all the time from the side room where the screenings were, and I think it's really important. You were in the previous discussion about the previous piece, you were very detailed about textures, how it's placed in museum and all that, and I think the way it's presented there is really awful. I mean, it's impressive, it's a big screen, but I've seen that 20 years ago. If this is a silent piece, why not allow it to be silent? And I was really annoyed by the building, the construction noise in the museum, by the noises from the screening on the side. So I really had to leave. I couldn't really appreciate it, although it's a nice view, but it felt very beliebig.
Right, too much contingent noise. Okay, thank you. Other views as to the meaning of the work, or are the role of the artist, the ego or the egolessness of this piece, the elegiac, the optical, the visual. We raised issues. We didn't, as Stephen said, we didn't nail it. So perhaps if someone in the audience would like to nail it, then, or at least add an instrument. No, or okay. Let's think then of Wangechi Mutu. Let's take ourselves back to Brooklyn and the dark continent of Mutu's work.
Oh dear.
Well, in quote unquote.
Do you see when I saw her work? For me, it's very similar to Raghib Shaw.
To what? Sorry.
Raghib Shaw, an Indian artist based in London.
I don't know the word.
Raghib Shaw. It's R.
Oh, Raghib Shaw.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Do you see similarity between these two artists?
Any panelists see a similarity between Raghib Shaw and no? But
perhaps you do.
You do. So tell us what the similarity is. And I know the name. I just can't visualize. I can't bring to mind a Raghib Shaw piece.
Okay.
Just quickly describe a Raghib Shaw, typical Raghib Shaw, and perhaps it'll flood back to our minds.
For me, the visual content of her work is very similar to her. The relationship between the elements and the creatures themselves. He is more detailed, and I think more strong.
I think it's best we all go away and have a look at Raghib Shaw and then have him in mind next time we think about Mutu.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Yes, quite a few hands going up on the Wangechi Mutu subject.
I guess the question I had in general is that in most of the collages, the figure, the contour that contains all the disparate elements is very provocative. The pose is very provocative, very solicitous. That's the outline that's containing all these various elements. And I guess I wondered if folks wanted to talk about the relationship between those two.
Between the contour.
The provocative solicitousness, sexuality of the outline of the figure, and then the fact that, I mean, not a lot of attention was paid to that aspect, more to the grotesque sort of conglomeration of elements, whether they're technical, foreign body parts.
Yeah, there's seductresses in some cases. Mm-hmm. There's that one piece.
Lots of leotards. I actually issued a challenge on Facebook that nobody met. Luckily for my budget, I said I'd pay for the admission of anybody who came as a Wangechi Mutu But I don't think anyone did, so I saved myself $6. But yeah, there's a lot of sexuality. And what's that? What goes against that? What's the other thing?
Just maybe talk a bit more about that, or the relationship between that and the other elements that we're talking about.
Is there one other strong element that is the opposite of sex?
I think I understand your question, and that is the imagery of the collage that makes up the bodies. We didn't talk about that, and there's all kinds of like motorcycles and just a vast array of collage imagery.
We didn't resolve the issue, maybe, but we were saying it doesn't seem to bring the baggage, or else we were thinking about it in synthetic terms, as synthesis terms.
Yeah.
How does the fact that the overarching image is one of sexual provocation and solicitousness, how to have both in the conversation at the same time?
I don't think she's got the balance there yet. I think that the provocative nature of the images kind of trumps the imagery that they're composed as. So you don't, as I looked at them, I didn't regard that with a great degree of seriousness in terms of what she was getting at. I don't know, maybe somebody else has
another
thought.
That's interesting. So it was sort of like a default
vocabulary.
Good.
Yeah.
Use that.
Yeah,
kind of. Default pose, a default, when in doubt.
When in doubt, go to Playboy. I don't agree, actually. I think she has got her, in the collage works, I think that's where she's the most resolved and juicy in a way. And she puts together these sensuous, voluptuous, provocative, strong female identities, and she then makes it up Archimboldo-esquely out of a disparate array of machinery and chopped up porn and all kinds of other stuff. It doesn't seem to really have a very heavy message. It seems to almost be that sensuality is a kind of social construct, and that we're all made up of the same stuff.
Well, I mean, I think that it's a kind of an old, I mean, you know, so many, I feel like it's a pretty, she's making these into powerful women. You know, it's their sexuality. It's they're the ones who are wielding it. They're not these passive receptacles of the gaze or whatever. Mm-hmm. I guess I don't know whether it resonates so much for me anymore in that form.
And by the way,
I couldn't feel that.
Depictions of powerful women?
You know, being sort of sexual and taking, yeah, seizing their sexuality, and I'm going to get myself in trouble.
I think that's a really interesting thing, Fred, because I think some strategies have a lifespan, run their course. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is an exhausted. I'm going to get in trouble.
Well, maybe for one generation it's exhausted. But really, truth be told, sex is never going to get exhausted. I mean, when sex is exhausted, we won't be here anymore.
It's not. I mean, come on.
No, come on. Micheline Thomas was there last, and it's. Maybe I'm going to get into trouble now. But maybe it's part of an appeal to. No, there are in those two artists, clearly the allure, the strong female is a live trope. Now, if to the intelligent art viewing public at large, strong women is a really sort of cheesy cliche, then artists should only be dealing with the strong woman motif if they do it ironically. And if Micheline Thomas and Wangechi Mutu and some other artists, maybe Chris Ofili could throw in there, Chris Ofili is doing it ironically, but if those two are doing it quasi-ironically or not really ironically, then we have an issue.
Well, it's funny because I one thing nobody's mentioned here is that entire installation is right next to the dinner party.
Right.
You know, and I found that to be actually quite resonant, that there were those, that there was the dinner party, the issue of food and eating and sexuality and the explicitness of it, I thought that was a really pretty cool positioning of that of that installation. And
of course,
it also shows that, I mean, does it, what Stephen was asking before, you know, yeah, it's to me, it's going through that same material again in a funny way, and the question is whether it still resonates.
I found myself, in terms of the iconography, I found myself sort of fast-forwarding past the overall, you know, the overall composition and noticing, and I'll give an example, the very first piece that you see on the way in, because it has a very long, funny title, and it's a, which I have for you. Once upon a time, she said, I'm not afraid of, and her enemies became afraid of her, the end. And it's a sort of a hybrid figure, human, female human, and then a non-human. And there are funny things like Ralph Steadman, little sprays of ink up in the on the wall. And what I became very fixated on in that piece was the apparent equivalence of tribal sculpture. Her feet, or it's the reverse. Her feet are tribal sculpture, and her front feet and her rear feet are motorcycle parts or something like that. There's an implied equivalence between you know, traditional tribal forms and these kind of funny hybrid motorcycle-like machines. And the equivalence is implied because they both are positioned at the end of limbs. So that kind of thing was those kinds of puzzles were kind of more interesting to me.
Right, right. I can take one more comment on Mutu, and then we will need to move on. And I can see it. Yes.
Speaking of puzzles, I found one piece in there, and I'm not sure if it was part of the installation, but you did not mention the piece that was basically in the middle of the installation of the show, that was a bunch of what looked like trash bags.
They were
up
garbage
into balls.
Bags, yes. But then,
and I could find no caption for it, and didn't really tie it to any meaning. And I just wanted to see your thoughts on it.
Okay, that seemed to me the most Ophelia-ish moment in the show, and that
because
they look like turds. And that is a piece called Suspended Playtime, Packing Blankets, Twine, Garbage Bags, and Gold String. And it seemed to me decor, really.
Filler.
Yeah. So it... it wasn't bad decor. So that's... Anyone have any views on that?
Nothing to say about
no.
that piece.
Okay.
That was actually one of my favorite pieces in the show.
Yay.
Why were you running quiet on them? Why?
I was just waiting for the moment. David.
The moment. Well, the moment is here. Tell us why it's your favorite piece.
I felt, you know, Stephen kept saying he feels her strengths are pictorial, and I feel that her strengths are sculptural, and I really like the way she uses the materials there. And I was reading those floating balls as kind of like... dead souls or massacred, you know, indicators for people that have been massacred. And that came to me by just looking at the way the walls were painted and my feeling about that red line at the bottom being all this blood is being covered up and then these balls became very evocative for me within that environment. Mm. And I guess nobody else caught that, but that's what I saw.
Okay, fantastic. We must, we must move on. Let's dim the lights, please, and we'll look at the PowerPoint for our last two shows, which I hope we don't have to overly abbreviate our consideration of.